This tape is germane to today's presentation. It features Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland in a telephone conversation with the United States Ambassador to the Ukraine, Jeffrey Payette. This occurred in February of this year. In this phone conversation, they are clearly conspiring to overthrow the Ukrainian government and setting up a puppet government of the United States choosing. The reason the world has this tape is because the Russians electronically intercepted this phone call and released it on YouTube so the world would know what was actually going on.
Which you'll need to make, I think that's the next phone call we want to set up, is exactly the one you made to Yacht. And I'm glad you sort of put him on the spot on where he fits in this scenario. And I'm very glad he said what he said in response.
Good. So I don't think Cleet should go into the government. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I guess... You think... in terms of him not going into the government, just let him sort of stay out and do his political homework and stuff. I'm just thinking, in terms of sort of the process moving ahead, we want to keep the moderate Democrats together. The problem is going to be kind of like these guys. And, you know, I'm sure that's part of what Yanukovych was just calculating on all of this.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tony Book on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Cleach going in, he's going to be at that level, working for Yatsenyuk, it's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay. Good, but you want us to try to set up a call with them? Is the next step?
My understanding from that call, what you tell me, was that the big three were going into their own meeting and that Yats was going to offer in that context a three plus one conversation or 3+2 with you. Is that not how you understood it?
No, I think that's what he proposed, but I think just knowing the dynamic that's been with them where Klitschko's been the top dog, he's going to take a while to show up for whatever meeting they've got. He's probably talking to his guys at this point, so... I think you reaching out directly to him helps with the personality management among the three, and it gives you also a chance to move fast on all this stuff and put us behind it before they all sit down and he explains why he doesn't like it.
Okay, good. I'm happy. Why don't you reach out to him and see if he wants to talk before or after?
Okay, will do. Thanks.
Okay, I've now written, one more wrinkle for you, Jeff.
Yeah.
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write him that this morning?
Yeah, I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, the EU.
No, exactly, and I think we've got to do something to make it stick together because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it. And again, the fact that this is out there right now, I'm still trying to figure out in my mind why Yanukovych did that. But in the meantime, there's a Party of Regions faction meeting going on right now, and I'm sure there's a lively argument going on in that group at this point. But anyway, we could let Joey set up on this one if we move fast. So let me work on Klitschko, and if you can just keep, I think we want to try to get somebody with an international personality to come out here and help to midwife this thing. Then the other issue is some kind of outreach to Yanukovych, but we'll probably regroup on that tomorrow as we see how things start to fall into place.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me, VFR, saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and then get the knees to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
Okay, great.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm pleased and I'm honored to be here. The audience here, of course, has just heard the infamous intercepted phone message, the phone conversation between U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, Victoria Nuland, and U.S. Ambassador and coup engineer par excellence, if you will, Jeffrey Pyatt, that is U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine in Kiev. I don't think a more blunt, a more naked, a more egregious example of international power politics has ever been revealed to the world as what we just heard. We heard somebody very important in the U.S. foreign policy establishment, someone who, incidentally, though she's now occupying the position she does in the State Department under the Obama Democratic administration, was, during Obama's predecessor, George W. Bush's administration, was U.S. permanent representative or ambassador to NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Thus do political roles in the U.S. foreign policy establishment overlap political parties, as well as responsibilities to the U.S. establishment, the U.S. political establishment, and that of its transatlantic or Atlanticist partners in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is to say, the Western elite empire builders and their architects and executors operate simultaneously on behalf of U.S. international interest and that of its military allies in NATO. The roles are essentially coterminous. What Nuland states, you know, by the way, the group of functional illiterates that is running this political establishment, to listen to Mr. Pyatt, you know, make inane comments like, what is the actual statement, the active neutron in this or something like that. But when he uses a mixed metaphor like, if this thing that is a U.S. engineered political transformation, the coup d'etat, gains altitude, his words, Russia may try to torpedo it. That's quite a task, you know, to have a submarine fire a torpedo 25,000 feet in the air and knock out an aircraft, because that's what his metaphor implies. But evidently, you don't have to think logically, and you don't have to speak well, and you don't even have to refrain from using expletives, such as the infamous four-letter word that Ms. Nuland uses, in order to pass muster in the New World Order. Representatives of foreign imperial powers in the past, you know, at least had some pretense of education, sophistication, experience, the ability to speak coherently. Now that's no longer necessary because power is its own justification, and global uncontested power is the ultimate justification. It will soon be 6 years, 2 months from now, since Barack Obama received, again in a world that almost makes surrealism look like naturalism, received the Nobel Peace Prize for, you know, having been in office, actually was nominated for it, I think, shortly after moving into the Oval Office, without any experience. Certainly, you know, at this point, and we just had the, you know, this year is awarded, of course, and the Nobel Prize for Peace is awarded to people who do anything other than foster peace or combat war or militarism. You seem to be able to get it for opening a coffee shop in Nairobi or something, or being the Vice President of the United States who officiated over the bombing of 8 different countries from 1993 to 2001 for anything other than fostering peace. So of course, then perhaps the Obama receiving the Nobel Peace Prize in December of 2008 really wasn't so out of character. But during his acceptance speech, he first of all identified himself, and not in the least bit apologetically, as the commander-in-chief of 2 wars on the occasion of receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. And during the course of the speech, he made a somewhat carping statement to the effect that there is, unfortunately, in his, you know, by the tone of his voice, he implied, unfortunately, a reflective distrust of the world's sole military superpower. That's a quote. On the occasion, again, in the 21st century, of receiving the Nobel Peace Prize, he boasted of being commander-in-chief of 2 wars very far from America's shores, in Iraq and Afghanistan, in the Middle East and South Asia, and identified the country of which he is chief executive officer and, in his own words, commander-in-chief, as being the world's sole military superpower. Let us add history's sole military superpower. And let us keep in mind that 2 years or so after that, the U.S. so-called defense budget, the military budget, was in the neighborhood of $718 billion. That is, in real dollars, adjusted for inflation, that is the highest since 1945, that is the highest since World War II. in real dollars. That broke down to something like $2,300 every man, woman, and child in the United States. You want health care? You want affordable housing? You want universal education, including higher education, subsidized? $2,300 a person will probably achieve all of those things for you. But the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, which was much more interested in expanding U.S. uncontested global military power than he is taking care of the cannon fodder, who may not join the professional army, the professional expeditionary army, and go overseas to kill and die if they had decent educational opportunities and jobs at home. So in a way, you have to cultivate cannon fodder as you do any other product, and that seems to be one of our major products for export. Obama, on the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan, and incidentally, October 7th was the 13th anniversary, so 3 years ago, you know, talked about what he called the post-Cold War generation. I'm sorry, the post-September 11th generation of U.S. military forces, several million of whom have served, I believe it was 5 million if I'm not mistaken, had served overseas in that 10-year period. 5 to 10 million U.S. personnel had served overseas in combat zones for the most part in a 10-year period. So this is simply to frame the world situation in which we were discussing the Ukrainian crisis. Another anniversary occurred this year. It's the 20th anniversary of the creation of what the North Atlantic Treaty Organization calls, perfectly in keeping with every Orwellian component of NATO as a whole, Partnership for Peace. Partnership for Peace is a military program that has been used since 1994 when it was created to cultivate and to graduate the 12 new members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, all of them in Eastern Europe. They were respectively the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland in 1999, which joined NATO against the backdrop of the 50th anniversary Jubilee Summit in the United States, officiated over by Bill Clinton and Tony Blair. This is 50 years of a U.S. military alliance, the largest in history and one growing by the day. The incorporation of three former members of the Warsaw Treaty Organization, or the Warsaw Pact, in 1999, while NATO was conducting its first full-fledged war against a sovereign European nation that had not threatened anyone else, I'm talking about the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, in what was ultimately a 78-day lopsided air war against that nation. Monsieur Blair and Clinton and company in Washington are welcoming in three new members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the first to join the post-Cold War period. Keep in mind, the Soviet Union had dissolved 8 years earlier. If the purpose of NATO was in any way to supposedly defend Western or Central Europe against a Soviet onslaught, there is no prospect of that occurring after 1991 because there is no Soviet Union, notwithstanding which the U.S. and its allies welcome in three new members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. 10 years ago, and this is where the anniversary, another anniversary, by the way, the very first member of the Partnership for Peace in the former Soviet Union was Ukraine, and I think that's worth noting. It was seen to be a priority to get that nation, first of all, of the 15 former federal republics of the Soviet Union, into a NATO integration program, of which the Partnership for Peace being that. In 2004, a decade ago, the NATO summit in Istanbul, Turkey, registered the largest ever incorporation of new members into the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, 7 at one time, all in Eastern Europe, 3 of which were former Soviet republics, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. The other 5 were Bulgaria and Romania, and we'll have occasion to talk about them because being Black Sea nations, they're an integral part of the plan of which Ukraine is also a component, but also Slovakia and Slovenia, Slovenia being the first former Yugoslav Federal Republic to come into the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The history of NATO is basically countries that are bombed or subsequently absorbed into the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, so their sons and daughters could be used in the next war against the next defenseless nation. And I'll catalog that a little bit later, but that applies to NATO's air war in the Bosnian Serb Republic in 1994, 1995, the 78-day air war against the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia in 1999, the war in Afghanistan, which has been NATO's war for the last decade or more, since 2001. NATO's involvement in Iraq, about which not enough is known, but will be, I hope, before we're done today. NATO's war against, a six-month-long war against Libya in 2011 and so forth. Subsequent to that, Bosnia is now a member of the Partnership for Peace Program. Serbia is a member of the Partnership for Peace Program. Libya has been identified immediately after the overthrow and murder of Muammar Gaddafi as being a candidate for another NATO partnership program called Mediterranean Dialogue, which takes in countries in North Africa and the Middle East. Afghanistan was identified 2 years ago, immediately before the NATO summit in Chicago, as being a member of one of NATO's newest programs and the first that is not geographically specific. And I think the title alone is worth registering. The name of this program is Partners Across the Globe of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The eight initial nations are Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Mongolia, Australia, New Zealand, South Korea, and Japan. Mongolia borders both Russia and China. Kazakhstan, which is the first country outside of Europe proper to get an advanced NATO partnership program, also borders both Russia and China. The only other country that does is North Korea. South Korea is embroiled in a standoff with its northern neighbor that could erupt into full-fledged war at any point. It is a NATO partner. Japan is involved in territorial disputes with both China and Russia, in the case of Russia over the Kuril Islands, which the U.S. State Department routinely refers to as the Northern Territories, which is a Japanese designation for the northern Kuril Islands, can be involved, again, in a military conflict with Russia and or China, is also now a NATO partner, and so forth. At the recently concluded NATO summit in Wales, in Newport, this summer, NATO came up with another category of enhanced partnerships and identify those new enhanced partners as Georgia, Finland, Sweden, Jordan, and Australia. So the point I'm trying to establish is that what happened with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War is that far from the U.S. dismantling, reciprocating, right? I mean, first in 1991, the Warsaw Pact, Warsaw Treaty Organization dissolved itself formally in 1991. It had been moribund and effectively dead for years in advance of that, of course. But in that same year, of course, the Soviet Union dissolved and fragmented into its 15 federal republics. At that point, far from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization dissolving itself, it decided to expand and set up programs like the Partnership for Peace, the Mediterranean Dialogue, to increase its membership from 16 countries at the end of the Cold War and the breakup of the Soviet Union into 28 members currently. That's a 75% increase in membership. It has then built up military partnerships on every inhabited continent, every inhabited continent. It has military partnership in the works with Colombia. Colombia provided military personnel for NATO's International Security Assistance Force war in Afghanistan and across the border, incidentally, into Pakistan. During the war in Afghanistan, which is now in its 14th year, the longest in that country's history, the longest in the history of the United States, NATO's first Asian war, or war outside of Europe, NATO's first ground war. When NATO took over the International Security Assistance Force, NATO and the U.S. employed the Afghan war to build up an international, integrated, expeditionary military strike force, which included military personnel from over 50 countries. Over 50 countries. Never in the history of human warfare have 50 countries been belligerents in one war, much less in one theater, even less in one country. And what NATO has boasted of in the interim, including at the Wales summit, is the fact that this is now the prototype for mechanisms like the NATO reaction, the rapid reaction force, the NATO other expeditionary forces that have now integrated the militaries actually of over 50 countries. And we have to keep in mind there are 193 countries in the United Nations, including any number of tiny statelets that hardly count. So those 50 countries are well over a quarter of the nations in the United Nations, but they're well over a third of countries that count, if you will. And that these have now been subordinated and integrated into NATO's, what NATO loves to refer to as interoperability. And that includes of weapon systems, of fighting doctrine, of language. All NATO exercises are conducted in English, of course. When any two NATO partners get together, their defense chiefs or their military chiefs of staff, the discussions are conducted in English, of course. There have been meetings in Brussels at the military headquarters of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in recent years of what NATO designates by the acronym CHOD. That's Chief Heads of Defense, if I'm not mistaken. There have been meetings that have included 64 heads of national militaries, the equivalent of our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, for example. 64, over a third of the nations in the world. So we have to know what we're talking about. If people simply walk into the movie that is the Ukraine crisis at any point over the past year and do not recognize what has preceded it, it is almost impossible to gain an accurate perspective on what's at stake and what has occurred. Let me also mention this. You know, during the since the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, and the fact, as I mentioned, you know, 3 years. No, I mean, the ink is barely dry on the document establishing Ukraine as an independent country before the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the Pentagon are in Kiev, making sure they can integrate it into a U.S.-dominated global military structure. Similarly, the U.S. immediately goes to work to set up transportation and energy arrangements that exclude Russia, one of which is known by the acronym GUAM. For the countries involved, they are Georgia, Ukraine, Azerbaijan, Moldova. This was set up by the Clinton administration about the same time as the Partnership for Peace was created, that is, about 1994, perhaps even that exact year. And at the same time, the United States, through the State Department, engineered what was called the deal of the century, the energy deal of the century with Azerbaijan, one of the four countries in Guam, to begin the process of pumping Caspian Sea oil and routing Caspian Sea natural gas through the South Caucasus to drive Russia and Iran out of the European energy market permanently. The NATO expansion already dictates that one of the elements of interoperability is weapons interoperability, and this has been an absolute goldmine for the merchants of death in the West. This means that all the former Warsaw Pact countries, all the former Soviet republics, excluding Russia, that traditionally dealt with Russian-made or Russian-designed weapons are now told those are not interoperable with NATO. From now on, you buy your weapons from the United States, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and, interestingly enough, Sweden. In recent years, during the post-Color Revolution, if you will, administration of Viktor Yanukovych in Ukraine, when we are now led to believe that Mr. Yanukovych was a horrible tyrant, he was corrupt, he was anti-democratic and so forth, all of which may well be true, but if so, no worse than his predecessors and certainly no worse than the chocolate king or Baron Petro Poroshenko, the billionaire, who has taken over the country in the interim. But several things that are not noted, and I think people in the West have a responsibility to know them. Ukraine was identified by the U.S.-dominated NATO military bloc as being one of four countries outside of NATO that was going to join the international NATO response force. The others are, interesting, revealingly enough, Georgia, Finland, and Sweden. I don't know how many people in Finland and Sweden, but certainly in the world as a whole, realize that Finland, which had not been at war since World War II with the Soviet Union, Sweden, which had not engaged in combat operations for two centuries, have hundreds of troops in northern Afghanistan, engaged in combat operations under NATO command, that Swedish and Finnish troops have killed and have been killed in combat in northern Afghanistan, where they're in charge of four provinces on behalf of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. That Sweden supplied several warplanes for the war against Libya in 2011. This is, you know, so-called neutral, so-called pacifist Sweden. But Sweden is, you know, the ruling elite in Sweden is doing very well. They're selling Gripen air fighter aircraft and other arms around the world. Sweden is one of the major exporters of arms around the world. A few years ago, Sweden abolished the last remnant of conscription with its military. That is, no longer are any Swedes being drafted in the armed forces. Heaven forbid, that would suggest territorial defense. That would suggest you have an army to protect your own nation. Part of NATO doctrine is professionalization of the armed forces. That means an end to conscription. That means a professional army where you join not to defend your own country, you join to be deployed as the U.S. tells you to any part of the world, to any combat zone in Africa, in Europe, in Asia, in any place else. One of the new parts of the transformation of the Swedish Armed Forces is every person who joins the Swedish Armed Forces, man and woman, has to sign a disclaimer, a waiver, stating they agree to be deployed anywhere in the world. This is Sweden. Sweden is under its Foreign Minister Carl Bildt, about which we're going to have a little bit more to say before this afternoon's over, has played a major role in the direct precipitant for the war in Ukraine. And I want to tell you, by my count, today is day 180 in the war in Ukraine. 180. On April 15th, the rump government, the post-coup regime, the junta, in Kiev launched what it refers to as an anti-terrorist operation, which has a very interesting acronym in English, of course. It's ATO. If they had simply taken the additional step of referring to it as the National Anti-Terrorist Operation, we would have had a more interesting acronym, of course, and one that was much more revealing as to its actual architects. Today is day 180 in the war against the people of the Donbas basin in southeastern Ukraine. It flares, you know, technically there's a ceasefire, but there's still active fighting occurring, including for control of the airport in Donetsk. Within the last 48 hours, Petro Poroshenko, the nominal president of the country, has announced that he has dismissed the titular governor of Donetsk, who I presume is living in Kiev, if he's not living in Berlin or Brussels, in favor of a military commander. We have to keep in mind the junta in Ukraine has already introduced what is effectively universal conscription, that every male between the ages of 18 and 40, if I'm not mistaken, has to register with the draft board. This is a country rapidly approaching total war, but 180 days of war. How did this whole crisis begin? It began on November 21st of last year when Viktor Yanukovych decided that he was simply postponing a decision to sign what is called an association agreement with the European Union. You know, within weeks, within days, within hours perhaps, tens of thousands of Ukrainian youth, for the most part, are out in Maidan Square, Independence Square in the capital city of Kiev, in a replication of the color revolution scenario of 2004-2005, as though the most burning issue to a young person in Kiev is not the video game they're playing, as it is with young people around the world, regrettably. It's not, you know, the latest popular culture concert they're going to. It's that, heaven forbid, the association agreement is not being signed. I defy anyone to tell me that that kind of spontaneous outpouring of people going into Maidan Square and setting up tent camps again and throwing Molotov cocktails at law enforcement officers, and as many of us have seen on YouTube, setting them afire, is because they were disturbed that an association agreement was not being decided against, but simply being postponed. The association agreement with Ukraine, as it is with the other Guam countries, let's see how the pieces fit together, with Moldova and with Georgia in the first instance, are under the auspices of a program called the Eastern Partnership. The Eastern Partnership was set up in 2009 by two countries, Sweden, Foreign Minister Carl Bildt, and Poland Foreign Minister Radek Radoslav Sikorski. Mr. Sikorski lived in the United States for a long time. He was a member of a major conservative think tank. His wife is an American journalist, Anne Applebaum. He was a BBC correspondent and British citizen in the 1990s. Mr. Sikorski has no right to be foreign minister of Poland. But Mr. Bildt and Mr. Sikorski set up the Eastern Partnership, which identifies the six former members of the Soviet Union, excluding those in Central Asia, for which, incidentally, there is an analogous European Union program to incorporate them as well. But for the six members of the former members of the Soviet Union, excluding Russia, that have ever been in the Commonwealth of Independent States, that is the trade economy bloc that emerged from the former Soviet Union, excluding the three Baltic states, which in 2004 joined both the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the European Union. Those six countries are Belarus, Moldova, and Ukraine in Europe, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Georgia in the Caucasus. The intent of the Eastern Partnership is to wean those six countries out of the Commonwealth of Independent States, to isolate Russia not only in Europe, isolate Russia in former Soviet space, to destroy any post-Soviet autonomous, or aboriginal, if you will, economic or political formations within the former Soviet Union, to isolate Russia completely from its former Soviet colleagues. It's more dangerous than that. The Guam countries are bad enough. And by the way, the Guam countries, the deal of the century, the Guam countries were set up for two purposes. And this was divulged by a former State Department fellow, Matthew Breza, who was in the U.S. Embassy in Poland during the Solidarność period, was in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow during the transition from Gorbachev to Yeltsin, who was recently the U.S. ambassador to Azerbaijan. You're getting some picture of who Mr. Breza is. But he talked about the energy corridors that were set up under the Guam arrangement 20 years ago, he said, were surprisingly enough the very same corridors running the opposite way to bring troops and military materiel and equipment for the war in Afghanistan. The two are part and parcel of the same project. But that Azerbaijan, which is an energy-producing country on the western border of the Caspian Sea, and Georgia, and Ukraine, and Moldova, Guam, were going to be used as a main transit corridor for a Caspian Sea oil and natural gas to, again, exclude the other two Caspian Sea littoral states, Iran and Russia, from any energy dealings in Europe. That's part and parcel. But Ukraine then is a very pivotal part of that arrangement. And during the Viktor Yushchenko government, of 2005 to 2010, the Ukrainian government, on U.S. orders, was engaging what it was called reverse flow transit of natural gas. Rather than going from east to west, it was going from west to east. It was meant to knock Russia again out of the natural gas market in Europe. I should add, I don't believe I've said it since the camera was turned on, that Mr. Yushchenko, America's so-called freedom exemplar, a paladin of democracy in Ukraine, who supposedly was deprived of his runoff election victory in 2004 and won in a third round, I think, I don't know if it's illegal according to the Ukrainian constitution, certainly unprecedented. But during the so-called Orange Revolution, he became president. His wife, Catherine Yushchenko, was born and raised in Chicago. She's a graduate of the University of Chicago. She was worked for the White House, the Treasury Department, and the State Department during the Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. I'm going to make a statement that I think has not been made sufficiently before, and I'm going to say that in the post-Cold War period, that the U.S. has basically sent people to govern Eastern European nations, including former Soviet republics, in a manner not dissimilar to what the Ottoman Empire did under the Janissary system, where they basically took people from the conquered country or descendants thereof, brought them back to the metropolis, indoctrinated them in their religion in the past, political ideology currently, sent them back to govern on behalf of the metropolis. Currently, the president of Estonia, who is arguably the most belligerent and calling for everything short of war against Russia, is a man named Tuomas Ilves. He was raised in the United States, worked for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which is safe for the State Department at the very least. 5 years ago, his colleague in Lithuania was Valdis Adamkus, who left with his family, left Lithuania at the end of World War II with the Nazi Wehrmacht, lived in Nazi Germany until the end of the war, came to the United States, also worked for the federal government. He was Nixon's Environmental Protection Agency chief. He lived in Chicago for decades. When the Soviet Union broke up in 1991, he went back and became president of Lithuania as Ilves became president of Estonia. 5 years ago, the president of the third Baltic state, Latvia, was a woman who was born in Morocco, if I'm not mistaken, raised in Canada, where she worked for the federal government. So we see that, you know, the wife, and I would argue control agent for Viktor Yushchenko, is an American from Chicago. The president, up until recently, the president of Lithuania was a Chicagoan. The president of Estonia to this day is an American. And this goes all the way down the line. So when we hear Victoria Nuland state, you know, of the three, you know, major, the triumvirate of opposition figures, who will occupy which position, that should not surprise us. This is exactly what the U.S. has done for the last 23 years in Eastern Europe. Now, during the, again, infamous Yanukovych government, which would have ended anyway in March of next year when scheduled presidential elections were to have occurred, where there was no reason to set the capital of a European country aflame and ultimately plunge it into a six-month war, and cause a massive political destabilization of arguably the entire European continent, fraught as it is with the potential for direct military conflict between the world's two nuclear superpowers. There was no need to do that if a presidential election was going to be held in 13 months anyhow, right? But to listen to the apologist of this bloody coup d'etat, and I'm thinking most particularly of Mr. Obama's speech at the General Assembly recently, where he talked about justifying this thing. And as I've had occasion to mention to people over the past 6 months or so, if we were to employ Mr. Obama's rationale, his logic, that because the people of Ukraine were fed up with a legally elected and universally recognized president, they had the right to go out in the street, murder police officers, at least 12 were killed, set fire to parts of the city, overthrow a government, and plunge the country into chaos because Mr. Yanukovych wasn't popular, I would be willing to wager that Yanukovych's ratings in the country, you know, given where his support came from in the East and the South, were higher than Mr. Obama's are currently, then Mr. Obama had better watch what he's advocating. Because if turnabout is fair play, he could be out of the White House and Washington, D.C. could be in flames. But nobody, regrettably, in the United Nations mentioned that point afterwards, as I believe it could and should have been made. Mr. Yanukovych did a couple of things. He sent a very small contingent of Ukrainian troops to serve under NATO in Afghanistan, much smaller than his predecessor, by the way, Leonid Kuchma, who as part of the arrangement with NATO's Partnership for Peace had to prove his bona fides to NATO and the United States by sending almost 1,000 Ukrainian troops to Iraq. And by the way, another fiction that really needs to be, we need to be disabused of, is the idea that somehow NATO is independent of the United States, can take an independent position vis-a-vis the United States, and that that's exemplified by, there's only one example, of course, people can say, but it's exemplified by Iraq in 2003, right? That's what we're told. NATO stood up to the United States and said, no, Mr. Bush, we are not participating in the invasion and occupation of Iraq. That is a flagrant lie. That is so inaccurate, I don't know where to begin, but I can say this, that in the weeks preceding the Anglo-American invasion of Iraq in March of 2003, NATO invoked Article 4 of its Washington Treaty or North Atlantic Treaty, which is a mutual defense clause, and sent advanced Patriot missile interceptor missile batteries to Turkey, as it had, incidentally, in 1991 before the first war against Iraq. and that it sent missiles near the Iraqi border as an act of solidarity with the United States and Britain on the eve of the invasion of Iraq, and that during the occupation of Iraq, of the current 28 members of NATO, 23 had troops in Iraq. And those that did not, Germany, France, Canada, Luxembourg, Belgium, had compensated by sending additional troops to Afghanistan to serve under NATO. So let's be clear about this. The Iraqi military to this day, this may be one of the reasons it folded up in the face of the ISIS onslaught, was trained by the North Atlantic Treaty Organization under what's called the NATO Training Mission Iraq. It's also a NATO Training Mission Afghanistan, the first head of which was David Petraeus. So Iraq, as I mentioned a moment ago, is a member of the new NATO program, Partners Across the Globe. Mr. Yanukovych, before he was overthrown, not only lent NATO to being, as I mentioned, one of only four non-NATO countries that was going to join the International NATO Response Force, and will, no doubt, he was also the first country. I mean, Yanukovych made Ukraine the first country to supply a warship for NATO in what's called Operation Active Endeavor. Operation Active Endeavor is a permanent military, a naval surveillance and interdiction operation in the entirety of the Mediterranean Sea that is part of NATO's Article 5 Mutual Military Assistance Clause, its war clause, which was invoked for the first and to date only time after the events of 9/11 in the United States in 2001. In the intervening 13 years, NATO warships are patrolling the entire Mediterranean Sea, from the Strait of Gibraltar to the Bosphorus to the Suez Canal. No ship can enter or exit the Mediterranean Sea without being monitored by NATO, which can then board it. Every country bordering or in the Mediterranean Sea, and there are two island nations, Malta and Cyprus, every single one, with the exception of, to date, Lebanon and Syria, are members of NATO, are members of NATO's Mediterranean Dialogue or a Partnership for Peace program, or are slated to be. That is, Cyprus is going to, the last holdout, because it had left-wing government until the U.S. got all the opposition parties together in Cyprus and made sure that Akel government was defeated a year and a half, 2 years ago, for people who don't know this. And you know, now Cyprus is slated to join the Partnership for Peace program. That means, in addition to the military bases that Britain retains in Cyprus, there will now be NATO-US military bases in Cyprus, right across from Lebanon and Syria, of course. Right. As I mentioned, Libya was slated to join it was announced by NATO that Libya would join the Partnership for Peace program immediately after the overthrow of the Gaddafi government. The only two states then in or bordering the Mediterranean Sea that are not part of NATO in one form or another are Syria and Lebanon. They are both slated, of course. As soon as the U.S. and its NATO allies can succeed in overthrowing the government in Syria, with Lebanon rapidly following suit, are, I'm sure, to be incorporated in the Mediterranean dialogue. So what we're seeing is that the U.S. has used NATO not only to subjugate the entire European continent in a way that, frankly, Napoleon Bonaparte or Adolf Hitler never dreamt of. That is, that the entire European continent, excluding Russia, is under the thumb, under the heel of a U.S.-dominated, aggressive, internationally oriented military bloc. Every country in Europe, except for micro-states like the Vatican and Monaco and Liechtenstein, is a member of NATO or a NATO membership program. Every single country in Europe. Ukraine under Yanukovych, as I mentioned, was the first. Lent a Ukrainian a naval vessel to Operation Active Endeavor in the Mediterranean, became the first non-NATO country to do so. He then immediately afterwards assigned a Ukrainian military vessel to what's called Operation Ocean Shield in the Indian Ocean off the Horn of Africa. As people generally don't know that every European country except Russia is a NATO member or partner, or that every Mediterranean country is a NATO member or partner except for Syria and Lebanon. So I don't think they know that NATO also has a permanent naval operation and presence in the Indian Ocean, in the Arabian Sea. Recently, they killed a couple of Indian fishermen. They have fired on and wounded Iranian fishermen. They have, killed personnel from a Taiwanese ship. I mean, this is what's going on in today's world that people don't notice. Ukraine became the first non-NATO country to deploy a warship for Operation Active Endeavor. Operation Active Endeavor is complemented by Operation Atalanta, which is the European Union's first ever naval operation in the same area off the coast of Africa that is able to strike in Somalia, able to strike in Yemen, able to strike when called upon against Iran or Syria. And recently, the commander of that, and this is something worth noting too, this is another illusion I think has to be put to rest. If NATO is in no way independent of the United States, I mean, can you imagine for a moment Luxembourg vetoing an American military action? If there's a misconception that NATO is somehow independent of and is, multilateral alternative to the U.S. unilateralism and so forth, then there's an equally and perhaps even more insidious fiction that the European Union in some manner is distinct from NATO and the United States and is a counterbalance to it. Up until recently, the commander of Operation Atalanta, the European Union's naval operation in the Arabian Sea off the Horn of Africa, is a man named Richard Sheriff. He was simultaneously the Deputy Supreme Allied Commander NATO. It's always, by the way, a Briton, an Englishman, or somebody from the United Kingdom who occupies that second major position. The first one is always an American, back to Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was the first Supreme Allied Commander for NATO. And it's what they call a dual-headed military command. Whoever occupies a chief military position in NATO is simultaneously the commander of U.S. European Command, which is now, in effect, merged with U.S. Africa Command. So, for example, right now, U.S. Air Forces Europe is now U.S. Air Forces in Europe, U.S. Air Forces Africa, same with U.S. Navy Europe Africa. So you're beginning to see, there's something actually called the Berlin Plus Agreement, under which the European Union and NATO share military facilities, military equipment, vessels, commanders, as I have indicated. And part of the Eastern Partnership dictated association agreement with Ukraine that was at least the nominal precipitant for what's been happening since last November is a very, I invite people to read it, you can see it online, the proposal, which has now been signed, of course, by the puppet regime in Kiev. It includes a very, very strong military component. And it would, it is designed to, and is already, I'm sure, as we speak, integrating Ukraine deeper and deeper into the Western military alliance, not only for the European Union, but because European Union and NATO overlap at almost every point, into NATO itself. This is basically a backdoor for Ukraine into NATO. And, we've seen where Ukraine has been, under successive administrations, Kuzma, Yushchenko, Yanukovych, bent over backwards to accommodate the United States and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. That, I might suggest to anyone who believes that you can placate the United States by groveling in front of it, I think the fate of Mr. Yanukovych ought to be an object lesson. And if you're going to go down, brother, go down fighting. History is going to be kinder to you. Mr. Quisling in Norway and similar characters, don't come off very good in the history books. Now, what's going on in Ukraine is that, and I think this is a case where there's, chronology and causality are being reversed. The West, the Western control of international media and other opinion-forming mechanisms. We would be wise to recall that in his, infamous, a book of 1997, Zbigniew Brzezinski, arch-Russophobe and former national security advisor in the Carter administration, who by most accounts was the real foreign policy architect during the Carter administration. There's also a rumor afoot, which I think is fairly well substantiated, that he himself did end Secretary of State Cyrus Vance and had him resign under a cloud, and that Mr. Brzezinski effectively engineered a major transformation of world politics in a way that we're still suffering the consequences of. But in 1997, in his book, The Grand Chessboard, in addition to referring to Russia as an unnatural political entity that logically ought to be trifurcated into, you know, the South, East, and West. He also talked about, you know, the fact that, and, you know, the Western part, by the way, would be something very dangerously close to what, if you, people can look this up on the web, what Alfred Rosenberg and others in the Third Reich had proposed for dividing up the former Soviet Union into economic, you know, grain belts and energy resource areas and so forth. There's something quite like that is occurring for the same reasons in geopolitics. You know, the name of the head of state of a country may change, you know, where it is and what it has does not. And it should not surprise us, you know, that we see parallels with events going back as far as the Crimea War. You know, where at that time Napoleon III in England and Britain, you know, allied themselves with the Ottoman Turks to prevent Russia from getting a warm water port, you know, in the Mediterranean. And I think it's worth, you know, noting also that Crimea is still important for exactly that same reason. And that Russia's Black Sea Fleet is based, of course, in Sebastopol in Crimea. And that there was no question but that if a major transformation occurred in Ukraine, which would yank it out of the Commonwealth of Independent States, and by the way, it is now, if not officially, practically and irrevocably outside of the Commonwealth of Independent States, which say the second most populous country in the former Soviet Union has now been pulled out of the you know, the post-Soviet Commonwealth of Independent States and is going to be incorporated into the European Union. That is a tremendous economic and geographical and security blow to Russia. We now can envision the fact that Ukraine moving towards both the European Union and NATO, the two of them going hand in glove. By the way, it's also a fact worth noting, and I don't think people have paid proper attention to it, that it, far from using the European Union as the carrot to entice people into NATO, the U.S. has used NATO as the precondition for countries getting into the European Union. Let's keep in mind that when Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary come into NATO in 1999, they then get the green light to go into the European Union. Same thing with most of the seven countries that joined in 2004. So we see a European Union that is you know, very suspiciously non-European. And that, you know, many of the calls are being engineered, notwithstanding Mrs. Victoria Nuland's statement about the European Union, the EU is a faithful hand-servant to the United States, as is, you know, if we listen very attentively to her statement, as is, have been, the two former two most recent Secretary Generals of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon and Kofi Annan, both hand-picked puppets of the United States, who did the U.S.'s bidding at every turn. And when Victoria Nuland reveals that Mr. Ban Ki-moon will dance to our tune, he does. So, you know, that's not to suggest a, you know, how would I put it, U.S. control of international mechanisms is so thorough that it's fruitless to combat them. But it's to have a realistic perspective about what we're actually dealing with and not to believe that our forces may be stronger than they actually are. That's a fatal thing to do if you're going to engage in any kind of battle, including political. But I think what we need to know about the situation of Ukraine right now is that after the NATO expansion of 2004, a decade ago I mentioned, the U.S. immediately went to work building up its military presence along Russia's western border. That is, within days of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania joining the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO took over the major air base in Lithuania, and in the interim has been flying so-called air policing, which is, say, air patrols, with major advanced new generation multi-role combat aircraft on four-month rotations. They were formerly four warplanes at a time. It's up to 20 now. And as a former Russian defense ministry official said right at the time, he says, these planes are 20 minutes from St. Petersburg. That is, you can take, you know, potentially in the near future, a super stealthy fifth generation fighter bomber and strike the second largest city in Russia. I'm sorry, he said 5 minutes. 5 minutes from Petersburg, 20 minutes from Moscow. So we have some idea what's been going on. Now what has happened in the interim is U.S. has taken control of and upgraded a similar air base in Estonia and is working on one in Latvia as well. In 2008 and 2009, Condoleezza Rice, then Secretary of State, the way these matters are arranged is it's the State Department that goes and signs the military deal and then the Pentagon comes in and delivers on it. So Condoleezza Rice went to Romania and Bulgaria in 2008 in 2009. Keep in mind they just joined NATO four or five years earlier in 2004. She then secured the rights to 8 major military bases in those two countries, including 3 major air bases. Those air bases, by the way, had already been used surreptitiously, if you will, for the attack on Iraq in 2003. They've been used in the interim for the wars in Afghanistan and against Libya. These are air bases, the 3 I'm talking about, capable of being upgraded to the level of what in military terminology would be strategic air bases, long-range bombers with a strategic payload, nuclear bombers. And the U.S. has built up steadily through the mechanism of NATO on the Black Sea and Bulgaria and Romania, a presence that is not only, as we talked about, the Mediterranean Sea being converted into a NATO sea, but we've had the president of Romania recently brag about the fact that the Black Sea is now a NATO sea, his words. There are 5 countries that are contiguous, you know, that border the Black Sea. They're Bulgaria, Romania, Ukraine, Turkey, Russia. 3 are members of NATO. Ukraine is heading towards NATO. That would leave Russia, which has a comparatively narrow strip minus Crimea on the Black Sea, the only non-NATO member. This would convert another, this, I mean, it's almost going back to the Crimean War of the 1850s in the sense that it's meant to box in and exclude Russia from most everything. Now, where does the Russian Black Sea fleet go? It goes to the Mediterranean. Where does it dock and refuel when it goes to the Mediterranean? Tartus, the Assyrian port city, right? The only place. They used to have Cyprus, but now the U.S. has engineered the defeat of the Akel party in Cyprus and got rid of the leftists, and now they have a compliant pro-NATO regime in Nicosia. So now, you know, Russia can't go to Cyprus. And if the U.S. has its way, they can't go to Tartus in Syria at the same time. I think what we have to look at, this is naked geopolitics and something very offensive about anything this reductive, I understand. And it offends me as much as it does anybody else. I hate to think of any human agency being reduced to self-interested geopolitics, but that's how the adversary works, and let's not fool ourselves. They are thinking about Caspian Sea oil. They are thinking about who turns the oil spigot on and off to Europe. The European Union is the second largest consumer of petrochemicals in the world next to the United States. Who controls, where they get their oil and natural gas from where, who pays for it and so forth is a matter of supreme interest to the United States. And that, you know, Iran already having been effectively excluded from the European market in terms of natural gas and oil, Russia's next. Once you knock Russia out of the energy market in Europe and you knock it out of the armaments market because of NATO expansion, Russia has no export products. Russia as an economy is dead. This is economic warfare. This is economic warfare of the sort that if the situation were reversed, I can tell you how the United States would react. When Russia, I'm not defending the Russian regime, I'm just talking about geopolitics regardless of who's governing whom. We can see in our own country how little it matters who's in the White House, in terms of foreign policy at least. And we can see vis-a-vis NATO how little it matters who was in the president's chair in Kiev, in Ukraine, right? I mean, they all went along. So that what we're seeing right now is I have described it as the fifth act. You know, we've seen the denouement, this is a climax. You know, we've seen, this is a fifth act of 20 years of NATO expansion. This is what it has led up to ineluctably, inevitably. This is what it was designed to do. Now, what do we hear in the West? The U.S. and its democratic allies, there are no other democratic countries in the world except those in NATO, you know, to believe the Western press, right? When they talk about the global community, the international community, the world community, they're talking about, as somebody once referred to, and a good way of gauging this, by the way, in the past at least, was when the former president of Iran would get up to address the U.N. General Assembly, and he would see 25 men, for the most part, walk up and leave at the same time. And they all looked remarkably the same. They were all white. They were the NATO countries. You know, some of their flunkies in the European Union, Australia, New Zealand, and Israel. That's the world community as the West defines it. There's no democracy, of course, in Latin America. There's no democracy in Asia. There's no democracy in Africa, right? I mean, this is what we swallow. This is what we allow to get past us sometimes without, you know, putting a stop to it, just halting it right there. Look, what the hell are you talking about? U.S. and its democratic allies have decided to protect innocent Ukraine, and not only Ukraine, but to protect, because we all know, you know, a Russian attack on Estonia, Latvia, Poland, Lithuania, Bulgaria, God knows, you know, is right on the agenda, of course. It's going to happen any minute. This is kind of hysteria, panic they've created in the West. And all Russia has done, rightly or wrongly, is decided that, you know, according to what is probably the constitutional law in Ukraine, that the autonomous republic of Crimea has the right to hold a referendum about whether they want to be independent or not. We certainly had no problem with that when it was a bloody breakup of Yugoslavia starting in 1991. We aided it and abetted it at every turn. We supplied arms to the belligerents against, you know, international UN-mandated arms embargoes. You know, we made sure that was as bloody a debacle as we possibly could, because the U.S. likes to eat its meal in tiny morsels. We have to remember that the Gerald Ford administration, subsequent to that, the Carter one, you know, fully endorsed the Helsinki Accords and the final document that came out of, you know, the Helsinki arrangements that stated that however less than optimal the borders in Europe were drawn after World War II, World War II being the last time up until, you know, recently, that anyone had attempted to redraw the borders in Europe, and it ended up in the loss of 50 million human lives, that however deficient in many respects the borders and the boundaries in Europe after World War II were, they were sacred and inviolable, and they were never going to be messed with again. There are now anywhere from 19 to 23 new countries in Europe since 1991. We have no problem with that. Right? The West likes to divide countries up. And not only do they divide the Soviet Union into its 15 federal republics and Yugoslavia into its 6 federal republics, with even tiny Montenegro having to be yanked out in 2006. We couldn't even tolerate that. It's a country bordering the Mediterranean. We had to have it. You know, whatever, 200,000, 600,000 people, it's hardly worth, you know, but we had to break it up that far. We then have to go even further. And you have to keep in mind the, you know, the socialists. Federal Republic of Yugoslavia was very much modeled after the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics in that it was a Leninist nationalities program that not only had federal republics based largely on ethnicity as well as geography, but had autonomous federal republics within the federal republics. So the U.S. then goes the next step and wrenches Kosovo out of Serbia. You know, former autonomous republic is now pulled out of a former federal republic. And this is kind of an infinite regress of breaking up countries into tiny, tiny, easily digestible countries. And, you know, in part, the breakup of Ukraine does not work entirely to the disadvantage of the U.S. And I would argue the U.S. is being very hypocritical in complaining about the Crimean situation, vis-a-vis Kosovo, certainly. I mean, how can you defend one and attack the other? But also, I should mention something, because I notice a lot of what I'm doing, and a lot of what we have to do in our day-to-day work with people, is spend what seems like a excruciatingly long period of time getting rid of falsehoods and misconceptions before you can talk about the simple truth. But one of them is this, that you hear, you know, a lot of when I was a revisionist revanchist in the West saying, if we had only given Ukraine a full membership in NATO in 2008 at the Bucharest summit, as they were demanding, that is our puppet regime of Yushchenko was demanding, or his wife, the Chicagoan Catherine Yushchenko was demanding more likely, and maybe Victoria Nuland was whispering in her ear, I don't know. But if we had only done that, then we'd never have this crisis, because we would then start World War III with Russia, right? Isn't that a consoling thought? The fact is, look, in Bucharest in 2008, NATO said to the two major countries, they're now, by the way, called aspirin countries, aspirin as in aspiring to be. I don't think a week goes by NATO doesn't come up with a new membership program of some sort. But the aspirin countries now are Montenegro, Macedonia, Bosnia, and Georgia. It would have been Ukraine, but for, you know, what's going on. In 2008, NATO said, Georgia and Ukraine will become full members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. In so many words, once they have met NATO standards appropriate to that inclusion. This is very important. There are two demands NATO places on a candidate country before they conclude what's called a membership action program. That's the penultimate program for full NATO membership. And they are these. No territorial disputes on the soil of the country aspiring to full NATO membership, and no presence of foreign military personnel. By foreign, let's be frank about this, we're talking about non-NATO troops. There are, and this is where NATO expansion, the Guam, Georgia, Ukraine, Azerbaijan, Moldova bloc, the Caspian Sea, this is actually a tri-continental system that Energy Nexus, that is also to take in Algeria and Egypt, by the way, in North Africa, northern Iraq, the Kurdish-controlled areas, really Turkish-controlled areas at this point, Israel. But you know, the general bloc that includes the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan oil pipeline from the Caspian into Europe, a comparable natural gas pipeline, a comparable rail line. This is a very complex situation that, if we had more time, we could delve into a little bit more deeply. But the other component in Guam, not only is Guam meant to be a transit corridor, from far east is Kazakhstan, where the U.S. plan for decades has been to build a pipeline under the Caspian Sea, from Kazakhstan to Azerbaijan, and then to have oil delivered from there through Georgia, which is why the first real color revolution occurs in Georgia. That's another component that links into with the Guam. I'll describe that in a moment. From Georgia to Turkey, from Georgia to Ukraine, from Ukraine to Poland, from Poland to the Baltic states, and the Baltic states to Germany and all of Europe. This is the final strategy to knock Russia out of the European energy market. The Guam countries have then several things in common, but two of them are very critical. Three of the four, but I have argued for years all four indeed, have so-called frozen conflicts. This is an expression used in international relations right now in regard to the former Soviet Union. That of the 15 former republics, four of them have unresolved conflicts, armed conflicts, at the very end of the Soviet Union before it broke up formally in 1991. And they are Karabakh or Nagorno-Karabakh, which is broke away from Azerbaijan and is now majority ethnic Armenian with an alliance with Armenia. In Moldova, it's Transdniester, which is a majority Slavic area, bordering Ukraine, which is important right now. In Georgia, it's Abkhazia and South Ossetia, and of course we know that 6 years ago a five-day war was fought between Georgia and Russia over South Ossetia. And I have argued that Crimea was always the fourth frozen conflict. So it makes this, the U.S. project of Guam all the more significant. It's a transit corridor for Caspian Sea oil and natural gas to come into Europe. It is a way of subjugating minority populations within the four countries, whose names form the acronym, and it's an effort to totally destroy the Commonwealth of Independent States. Now, we've reached a new level of intensification here too, because coming out of the former Soviet Union, not only is the economic and trade and energy bloc, CIS, Commonwealth of Independent States, something that was kind of thrown as a sop to Russia after the breakup of the Soviet Union. But Russia also set up something called the Collective Security Treaty Organization, CSTO, which is a security bloc. It has a military component. It has six members. The two members in Europe outside of Russia, by the way, it excludes Ukraine. Russia is accused of having subjugated Ukraine, but they never brought Ukraine into the CSTO. But the two European countries that are members, actually European and Caucasian countries, are Belarus and Armenia. As I mentioned earlier, Belarus and Armenia are amongst the six countries targeted by the European Union under the European Partnership Program. I pointed this out over 5 years ago, that the intent of the Eastern Partnership is to destroy all post-Soviet partnership programs of any sort, including military. And that what is necessary in Belarus and Armenia is a color revolution scenario to overthrow the governments of those two countries. It's been attempted in both countries, by the way. Let's look at the color revolution. began, first one in Georgia, 2003, second one in Ukraine, 2004, third successful one in Moldova in 2009, the so-called Twitter revolution. That means Azerbaijan is the only one of those four that has not had a successful color revolution. I'm suggesting the State Department and the Pentagon, NATO and the European Union, that is the Western elite that represents collectively probably 8% of the human race but has the temerity, the audacity, to routinely refer to itself as the civilized world or the world community, is playing with dynamite in Ukraine. Russia has been, far from the accusation that it's been aggressive. In my estimate, I believe that part of the crisis right now is that Russia did not take firm diplomatic action early on in the game to prevent this from occurring. But nevertheless, it's cast as the aggressor and as the villain. One questions how long the Russian military will tolerate incursions on its own territory, shelling by U.S. proxy forces and the Ukrainian armed forces across the Russian border. The killing of Russian civilians on Russian territory, this has occurred. The attack on Russian checkpoints and customs offices and so forth on the border. It's a question of how much longer this is going to be tolerated. If the war resumes, as we have every reason to believe it will, full-fledged, we can again be looking at the prospect of an extremely dangerous military confrontation in Europe, one that could have easily been circumvented had we been able to expose the machinations of the Victorian Newlands of the world in time.